Blast. All Hit Radio.
Welcome to the X Zone, a place where fact is fiction and fiction is reality. Now, here's your host, Rob McConnell.
And welcome back to the X-Zone, everyone. I am Rob McConnell. We're coming to you from our broadcast center and studios in Niagara, Ontario, Canada. If you'd like to give us a call, 1-800-610-7035. If you'd like to send an email, xzone@xzoneradiotv.com. On MSN Messenger, X-Zone Radio TV. And if you'd like to find out more about the X-Zone Radio Show and the X-Zone TV channel, visit us at www.xzbn.net and xzonetvchannel.com. My guest this hour is Dr. Katie Mack, and she is a theoretical physicist exploring a range of questions in cosmology, the study of the universe from beginning to end. She currently holds a position of assistant professor of physics at North Carolina State University, where she is also a member of the Leadership and Public Science Cluster. Throughout her career, she has studied dark matter, the early universe, galaxy formation, black holes, cosmic strings, and the ultimate fate of the cosmos. Alongside her academic research, she is an internationally recognized writer and communicator. She has been published in a number of popular outlets such as Scientific American, Slate, Sky and Telescope, and Cosmos Magazine, where she is a columnist, and she has recently been named TED 2020 Fellow. You can find her on Twitter all of the time at Astro Katie. Joining me now is Dr. Katie Mack. And Dr. Mack, welcome to the X-Zone.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, tell us a little bit about yourself and what exactly is a theoretical astrophysicist?
Yeah, so astrophysics is the study of the cosmos of objects in space, basically stars, galaxies, planets, all of the things out there. Mm-hmm. And the theoretical part is that I don't do observations and I don't do experiments, but I look at equations, I look at results, I write a lot of code, and I try and address those questions other than by actually taking the data myself.
I understand you have a very significant presence on Twitter. Tell me about that.
Twitter is a surprisingly great medium for talking about science. Mm-hmm. It turns out that it's very helpful to be able to directly discuss and engage with people who are not in academia, who are not scientists. And I talk about physics and astronomy. Mm-hmm. I talk about academia, about a whole range of other topics in science and just life. And it seems to be a really nice way to sort of build a community and get to know lots of people.
Do you find that more and more people are showing an interest in astrophysics, the universe, the beginning, the end, than, let's say, 20, 30 years ago?
It's hard to say. I haven't been around too terribly long, so I can't make too many direct comparisons about that. But I do think that there is a sort of basic desire among people everywhere to understand our cosmos, to understand where we came from and where we're going. And I think that most people, if you give them a chance to explore that, they'll mm-hmm. be interested. I think it's something that, you know, my job as a science communicator gets very easy when I get to talk about space and black holes and the Big Bang and things like that.
So let me ask you a very simple question. Sure. Where did we come from and when did it all begin?
Well, it all began around 13.8 billion years ago, right, as far as we can tell. And we know that in the very beginning, there was a the universe was hot and dense and in some sense smaller than it is today. That's the Big Bang theory, the idea right now the universe is expanding. If you take that expansion, dial it back, then the universe was compressed in the past and was hotter and denser. And we can study that time very directly because we can see the afterglow of the Big Bang. The place where things get a little bit uncertain are within the first, tiny, tiny fraction of a second. We don't know exactly where that hot, dense kind of primordial soup came from. We have some ideas about what could have produced that early hot stage.
Right.
And, I can get into those if you're interested, but we are very sure that the universe was hot and dense and has been expanding. Exactly what happened at the very, very, very beginning is still something that we have lots of theories about and we're trying to better understand.
I understand you've just written a new book entitled The End of Everything. That's a scary title coming from an astrophysicist, ma'am.
It really is about the end of everything. It's literal. It's about how the universe will come to an end sometime in the future. It goes through several possibilities for what we think might happen. Mm-hmm. Where by we, I mean cosmologists and physicists, people who are studying these topics. So it outlines a few possibilities and what the evidence for against those things are. And how we can study that question, how we can learn something about our far distant future in the cosmos.
How many different models do you use when you and your fellow scientists go out and say, all right, let's take a look at how this all could end? Is there one specific model or do you use many different models with different scenarios?
There are several different possibilities. There's one that's kind of the most accepted idea, mm-hmm. but in the book I go through five different possibilities, just to give a range of what people have been talking about, what the range of theories are that fit the data as it stands today, and where some new interesting ideas are coming from. So the one idea that seems to be the most accepted right now hypothesizes that, right now the universe is expanding and it's going to mm-hmm. continue to expand and it's actually expanding faster and faster all the time. And because of that, everything will get farther apart. The universe will get colder and more diffuse and darker over time. And after a while, there'll just be very little left. Everything will kind of fade away. And that's called the heat death. And that seems to be the one that is most accepted or most expected maybe because it fits the data. It's a clear extrapolation from what's happening now, and it doesn't require a whole lot of sort of new ideas to come in to get that to work. But there are other possibilities that people talk about quite seriously that fit the data right now, and some of them are much more dramatic than just a kind of fading away.
It seems as if from nothing we came to nothing we go?
Well, I mean, we don't know exactly what we came from. I mean, there are hypotheses about really coming from nothing, but that part's a little bit hazy. We may have come from a universe that was already existing and we kind of branched out from that. That's a possibility. It's possible that that our universe is cyclic, that there was a universe before ours that ended, and then we had our Big Bang, and then there could be another cycle in the future after our universe ends. That's still very much an open question.
After somebody reads your book, what do you want your reader to end up learning? And how do you hope that your words will change their life?
The first question is easier to answer. I hope that when people read my book, they learn a little bit about how our universe works, what we know about our cosmos. So in order to set the stage for all these cosmic apocalypses, I describe a lot of what we currently know about the cosmos and how we're learning it, how we can see the Big Bang directly by looking at this afterglow light that's still in the cosmos. I talk about how we measure the universe, how we figure out what distant galaxies are doing. I talk about stars and black holes and how galaxies come together. There's a lot of information in there, and then, you know, I also go into what we're learning about the end and what these possibilities are. So I hope that, you know, after reading the book, you come away with a better understanding of how we fit into the universe, you know, our place in this larger cosmos, and, you know, kind of a different perspective on existence, perhaps. And that touches on the second question you had. I hope that, you know, when I talk about cosmology, when I talk about the cosmos and our past and our future, a lot of what I'm hoping to do is to help people gain a different perspective, to be able to step away from daily life and the concerns of the moment, and really take that time to sort of think about that big picture and consider ourselves as residents of this grand, beautiful cosmos, where we may only exist for a short time, but it's an incredible thing that we can learn about it. We can see so much of what's going on in the cosmos, and we can find our origins and perhaps our destiny. And I think that's a wonderful thing. And I think that we should all have the chance to take that time to really contemplate our place in this universe.
Are we alone in this universe as a human species?
Right. We don't know. I don't think that that Earth is the one single place in the universe where life began. I think that's quite a that would be quite a leap to say that we're that special. We know that there are planets around most stars in the Milky Way galaxy. We know that rocky planets like our own that might be the right distance from the sun, from their own suns, to have liquid water on the surface. We know that those are not terribly rare.
Right.
That we know that such planets, which we would call habitable, although we don't know if they're actually inhabited or not, we know that those are reasonably common in the Milky Way galaxy. And we also know that there are places, even in our solar system, where the conditions we think were necessary for life to begin on Earth may have at one point existed in those places. You know, Mars at some point had liquid water on the surface. Mm-hmm. There are moons of the gas giants in the outer solar system that have liquid water oceans underneath their surfaces and even hydrothermal vents. So we know that the kinds of physical conditions that led to life on Earth probably exist elsewhere. Whether or not life did ever come up in other places, we don't know, although I think it's very likely. And whether or not that life evolved into something that we would recognize as alive or intelligent, you know, other than just some kind of microbe, that we don't know. And that's a lot less certain. I think that most astronomers would bet very strongly that there is other life in the universe somewhere. Whether or not there's intelligent life that wants to communicate with us, that's that's a lot, a much more uncertain question.
How do you, as an astrophysicist, look at today's space race, getting back to the moon, getting to Mars? Is this an essential part of our evolution in finding out the answers to the many questions that theoretical astrophysicists like yourself are trying to, you know, get answered?
Well, I think that a lot of the kinds of questions that can be answered by, you know, personally going to the moon or Mars are questions that could also be answered by robotic missions. I think that the drive for humans to walk around on another world is a strong one, and may have more to do with human nature than with science in a lot of ways. There are certainly things that we will learn more easily. There are ways we can explore more easily and more efficiently by going in person. But I think that what drives us to, you know, try to walk around on other planets is really more a sense of adventure,
right,
than specifically science necessarily. I think it's a mix of both, but I think if our only concern was gathering the best science, there would be, we would
sure,
probably put much more investment into robotic missions.
All right,
than
Doctor, we've got to take
missions.
Our break. Please stand by. ExoNation, our guest this hour is Dr. Katie Mack. Her website is AstroKatie.com. We'll both be back on the other side of this break. Don't go away.
Our whole universe was in a hot, dense state. Then nearly 14 billion years ago, expansion started. Wait, the Earth began to cool. The autotrophs began to drool. Neanderthals developed tools. We built a wall.
We built the pyramids. Math, science, history, unraveling the mystery that all started with a Big Bang.
Since the dawn of man is really not that long, as every galaxy was formed in less time than it takes to sing this song. A fraction of a second and the elements were made. The bipeds stood up straight, the dinosaurs all met their fate. They tried to leap but they were late and they all died.
They closed their asses off the oceans in Pangaea. See a wooden bar to be a set in motion by the same Big
And welcome back, everyone. This is the X-Zone. Dr. Katie Mack is our special guest, and she is a theoretical physicist. Her website is astrokatie.com. Talking about the Big Bang, one of the most popular shows on television these days, including in reruns, is The Big Bang, which is based amongst a group of scientists. Have you watched the show yourself?
Yeah, I've watched it. Actually, listening to the theme song just now, the first bit of the theme song is a very clear description of the Big Bang theory. So, you know, the whole universe was in a hot, dense state, then nearly 14 billion years ago, expansion started.
Right.
That part
yeah.
is completely accurate.
Son of a gun.
I use it in my classes to explain what we mean when we say the Big Bang theory.
Taking the title of your book, which is The End of Everything, where is your book available, Doctor?
Anywhere books are sold, really. You can get
Excellent.
It at bookstores, buy it online. It's an ebook, it's an audiobook. It's being published in many different places. So just wherever you like to buy books, check it out.
How will we know if the world is coming to an end? What would be some of the signs, the changes that we as humans would notice?
So do you mean world or do you mean universe? Because there are different answers.
All right, let's go with the world first and then go to the universe.
Okay, well, the world is... the world's days are numbered, I'm afraid. So we know that the sun is evolving, it's aging, and the way that it evolves is it's going to over several billion years, puff up and become a red giant star, become a much larger star. And as it begins that process, things will get hotter here on Earth. And by around a billion years from now, the oceans of the Earth will boil away. It will be so hot on the surface of the Earth that you will not be able to have liquid water on the surface of the Earth. And so by that point, we should probably be somewhere else. If humans still exist by then, we should probably find a new place to live. But then after the surface is no longer inhabitable, there will be a period where it's just getting hotter and hotter, and the sun, as it expands, will engulf Mercury and Venus, the two inner planets. And then it's unclear whether the Earth will spiral into the sun at that point, or whether it'll take a little while longer. The sun will blow off its outer layers of atmosphere, and then at that point probably the Earth will spiral into the sun. So the sort of final stages of habitability of the Earth will be noticeable by the brightening of the sun, really. So that's where we'll get that sign.
Would there be any way to avoid this total cataclysmic event?
I don't know of any. I think, you know, if there were a way to move the Earth out in its orbit, then you could keep it in the sort of habitable zone of the solar system as the sun gets hotter, but brighter. Pretty much we'll probably just have to live somewhere else at that point.
Well, this is a great show.
I mean, I have faith that if humans or some other kind of thinking creatures are still around in a billion years, that's enough time to find a way to live in space or to live on other planets.
Oh,
I think that's totally reasonable expectation.
So we're talking in the very far future when it comes to, as we humans look at time, but as I would imagine you as a theoretical astrophysicist looks at that, that's, you know, in a matter of minutes.
I mean, the universe has been around for about 13.8 billion years, so 1 billion years in that time is pretty short. And especially when we think about sort of the evolution of the galaxies and the evolution of the cosmos as a whole, A billion years is not a huge amount of time, but you know, I understand that that you know it is a large amount of time for the evolution of a species and technology. So I think that things could happen, that things could be very, very different by then.
How do you and your fellow scientists calculate the beginning of the universe?
Well, yeah, so that's mostly by looking at the way that the universe is expanding now and kind of dialing it back. So when we look out into the cosmos, when we look at very distant galaxies, we see that they're all moving away from us.
Right.
And it's not because we're unpopular. It's because the whole universe is getting bigger. And so the spaces between all galaxies, those spaces are getting bigger. And so we can just kind of reverse that based on what we know about how that expansion has been changing over time. And that gives us a date in the past, you know, a sort of number of years ago, where everything would have been kind of on top of everything else. And that tells us when the Big Bang would have occurred.
Something that we hear about these days when listening to science, you know, science people who talk about the galaxy, the universe, is dark matter. Can you explain to us what that is?
Sure. It's actually what most of my academic research is about. So it's a topic that's very dear to my heart. So dark matter is a kind of matter. So matter is anything that has mass, like, you know, our atoms and molecules are matter. The stuff we're made of is matter. So it's a kind of matter, it has mass, but it seems to be totally invisible. And if it's invisible, that means it also doesn't interact with light, but that means you also can't touch it, because it turns out when you're trying to touch something, actually what you're doing is you're pushing the electrons in your hand against the electrons in the thing you're trying to touch. And it's really electrostatic repulsion that makes you feel that thing is solid. And if dark matter is something that doesn't deal with light, it doesn't deal with electromagnetism, so you can't feel it. It doesn't feel solid, even though it has mass. And that's a counterintuitive thing, but it would be something that would pass right through you, even though it has mass. And the reason that we think it's out there, even though we can't see it, we can't touch it, and we haven't caught it in a detector yet, is because when we look out into the cosmos, when we look at the way that galaxies move around, when we look at how stars move around galaxies, they seem to be responding to the gravitational pull of something we can't see. And we can map out where that stuff has to be. And we can see that every galaxy seems to be embedded in a clump of dark matter, and clusters of galaxies are in these clumps of dark matter. And we have other indirect evidence for the existence of this stuff. It's not just, you know, you can't really just tweak gravity and make it all work out. There really does seem to be some stuff that's just invisible, but it's regular matter other than that. And yeah, it seems to be much more prevalent than regular matter. So something like 80 or 85% of the matter in the universe is dark matter, this invisible stuff.
So am I correct in understanding that what we perceive to be solid is not solid?
Well, it depends on what you mean by solid, really. And so, you know, every solid thing that you can think of is made of atoms and molecules, and those are held together by atomic bonds and molecular bonds, and and those are held, you know, those are governed by electromagnetism and you know, the forces between electrons and protons and all of that. So, you know, there are particles, there's kind of empty space between particles, but I mean, for all practical purposes, something that's solid is solid. It's just that when you're trying to touch something, the mechanism by which you touch something, by which something feels solid to you is that electric kind of repulsion between the stuff of you and the stuff of the thing you're touching.
So is that what differentiates the black matter from what we can physically touch?
Yeah, so dark matter doesn't seem to do that repulsion,
okay.
And regular matter does, and so that's kind of that, and you know, not being able to see the dark matter, that's what makes it different.
You also talk about vacuum decay. What is that?
So vacuum decay is one of the possibilities for the end of the universe that I talk about in the book. And it's the one that's kind of the most The most interesting to me as a physicist, it's mm-hmm. also a little bit hard to explain because it comes out of some kind of complicated ideas in theoretical physics, but it's basically the idea that there's a kind of instability built into our universe, and that instability is vulnerable to a kind of quantum event happening somewhere in space that could create a bubble of a different kind of space that could expand through the universe and sort of destroy everything. And this is an idea that's been around for a while and has gained more prominence recently. And it's not something that anybody that you should worry about. I hear from a lot of people that they learn about the possibility of vacuum decay and they get very, very concerned. And there are lots of reasons why we shouldn't worry about it. But it is the sort of thing where if it's possible, if it can happen, then we wouldn't be able to predict exactly when it would happen. We can get an idea of it would roughly, you know, probably happen many, 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 many years in the future. We can't say for sure that it wouldn't happen right away, but we can be reasonably confident that it wouldn't. And if it did happen, we wouldn't see it coming. We wouldn't really feel it. We wouldn't mm-hmm. notice it. It would just kind of erase the universe. And that's a very dramatic and slightly, you know, disturbing kind of end. And so I talk about it in the book, and it's one of the most interesting possibilities that I think out there.
We've had a number of people who dabble in science or are scientists who actually say that they believe, based on quantum physics, that there is more than that there are multiple dimensions, multiple universes sharing the same space and time as we do.
Do you mean the many worlds hypothesis of
yes.
quantum mechanics?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So that's an interesting idea. And, it's one that, that there are many physicists who take it seriously, but the way the idea behind the many worlds hypothesis is that, every time a quantum event happens. So by quantum event, I mean, you know, sometimes when you try and measure where a particle is, you won't get, you might get different answers. You know, if you do the measurement several times with particles arranged in the same way. So there's some quantum uncertainty in particle physics. And so if there are two options for a measurement and it involves these subatomic particles, then the idea behind many worlds is that, you know, the chance of measuring either of these results is 50-50, which means that in this universe we measure it, you know, the particle goes left, then there's another universe that branches off of ours in which the particle goes right. And so every time something happens, there would be this sort of splitting of the universe into two new universes. And that's, there's, you know, I find it to be a strange idea that, you know, you would just keep producing more and more universes mm-hmm. all the time in that way. But mathematically, there's something to be said for it. But the interesting, you know, the important thing about it is that it would be something where once that split occurs, it's impossible to interact with the other universes that branch off. There would be a complete disruption. So it's not like that means that we can, you know, travel between parallel universes or anything like that. It's kind of a way of mathematically accounting for quantum probabilities.
If this is just a mathematical calculation, how do we know that the actual mathematical equation works out to be this hypothetical or theory, you know, theoretical?
Well, I mean,
listen, I've got to take a break here. My producer okay. just said, Gilly, we have to take this break, so stand by. Okay. Exo Nation, our guest this hour is Dr. Katie Mack, and her website is astrokatie.com. We'll be back on the other side of this break as we continue here in the X-Zone from our broadcast center and studios in Niagara, Ontario, Canada. Don't go away.
ocean, higher than any bird ever flew, longer than there've been stars up in the heavens. I've been in love with you, stronger than.
And welcome back, everyone. Dr. Katie Mack is my guest this hour. Her website is astrokatie.com. And Dr. Mack is a theoretical astrophysicist exploring a range of questions in cosmology, the study of the universe from beginning to end. She currently holds a position as assistant professor of physics at North Carolina State University, where she is also a member of the Leadership in Public Science Cluster. Throughout her career, she has studied dark matter, an early universe, the galaxy formation, black holes, cosmic strings, and the ultimate fate of the cosmos. Alongside her academic research, she is an internationally recognized writer and communicator. She has been published in a number of popular outlets such as Scientific American, Slate, Sky and Telescope, and Cosmos Magazine, where she is a columnist. And she has recently been named a TED 2020 Fellow. You can find her on Twitter as @AstroKatie, and once again, her website is astrokatie.com. Again, Doctor, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Great pleasure talking to you.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, something else I understand you're... The question that I asked before we went to the break was, if all these... They're not facts, and yet they are facts. If they're just based on mathematical calculations, what would happen if the mathematical equation that we think is right isn't? What happens if Einstein was wrong? And in a few years from now, things change.
Well, you know, this is what physics is all about. We take our mathematical models, so we try and build a mathematical model of the universe, of whatever physical process we're studying. We try and figure out what kinds of equations could describe what's happening physically. And then we test that model. So we take more data, we see if it still fits the mathematical model. If it doesn't, we have to tweak the model, and we continue that process. With Einstein, you know, the mathematical equations he wrote down in 1905 and 1915 to describe space, time, and gravity, those equations still work. You know, every time we've taken data about gravity or about you know, how space and time interact with each other, it still matches Einstein's equations. So we're actually a little frustrated right now because we're pretty sure that there will be something that will disagree with that at some point. There's got to be some new model that can replace, you know, give the same answers in the regions we've tested, but in some new more extreme conditions should give a different answer than what Einstein's equation would say. But we haven't found it yet, and we really need to find that place where the data no longer match the equations in order to make progress. So we're always looking for that place where the data and the equations stop agreeing. That's how we build new theories, and that's how we figure out how physics works, and that's how we progress in our theories.
So how do you go about looking for this new mathematical equation? And when it is found, how is it going to change everything?
Well, what we're doing mostly is from the data side, we're trying to take more data in more extreme conditions. So we've only recently begun to learn about the extreme gravitational conditions around black holes. And we've done that in a few different ways. One, by building instruments that can feel the vibration of space and time when black holes are colliding with each other in the distant universe. So when two black holes collide, they send a ripple through space, and we can pick that up now with experiments called LIGO and Virgo. These are gravitational wave detectors. And that's a way to test Einstein's theories and see if they really describe the space-time around a black hole. And so far, they do. So we haven't found the crack there yet. We've also been studying the early universe. We've been taking data about the extreme conditions in the beginning of the universe and trying to figure out different, you know, how that might affect our particle physics models. And we haven't found the error there yet either. Like, that still matches theories that we have, but we're still looking. So we use experiments like the Large Hadron Collider at CERN, where we collide particles together at extremely high energies, and we hope to find something in the debris that doesn't match what we expected. So far, again, there's nothing really super definitive that's different. But there are places where we know that something is different. So we know that dark matter is not something that's included in our standard model of particle physics. And so that means that if we could understand more about dark matter, if we knew what that was, that might point the way to the next theory. And so that's one of the reasons we're so keen to figure out what dark matter is and to try to maybe detect it in a detector or look at something about how it interacts in space. So that's one of the ways that we're looking. We're also trying to understand dark energy, which is a different phenomenon. Dark energy is something that's making the universe expand faster and faster. And that also is not included in our theories as something that we knew about already. So we're trying to figure out what that is and how that fits into the bigger picture. So by examining these things that we're pretty sure don't fit into our current models, we're hoping to find where we can adjust the current models or replace them, where everything would kind of fit together and make sense.
How will theoretical astrophysics help the common person, the man on the street? The guy who goes to work from 9 to 5, he works in an office tower somewhere. Well, this is prior to COVID-19, of course.
Sure.
Or whatever. How will this help us, the people who aren't scientists, who really, you know, yeah, the sun comes up, it goes down, we're going to be dead by the time that everything comes to an end, according to the numbers that we've talked about here. So why should we have any interest in it?
In the end of the universe or in theoretical physics in general?
In physics in general.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing about fundamental physics, the thing about theoretical physics is we don't really know where it's going to take us. When the ideas behind quantum mechanics were first being put together, we didn't know that we would be using those to make microchips and flash memory and all of the extra electronics we have now. We didn't know that we'd be making scanning electron tunneling microscopes. We didn't know that we would be using positrons, antimatter particles, to do medical imaging. We just knew that there were weird things out there in space and there were weird things in our particle experiments and we needed to explain them. And now we have all these amazing technologies. When Einstein was working out his equations of general relativity and special relativity, you know, he thought he was talking about extreme conditions in space, but it turns out now everybody in their pocket has a machine that connects with GPS satellites, and those wouldn't work without understanding relativity. That's, you know, we have to factor in Einstein's relativity in order to have satellite positioning. So there are a lot of things where we don't know what the benefit will be. But based on past experience, theoretical physics has very much more than paid for itself in terms of new technologies and advancements in how we, you know, live our lives. But from my perspective, my interest in it, you know, I have to assume that something like that might come out of what we're doing, and I know that even now there are technologies we're using to do things like gravitational wave detection that are branching out and going into other industries. But for me, I think that it's more about human curiosity. I think that we as humans, we want to understand the universe we live in. We want to understand where we came from and where we're going. And that's just human nature. That's our innate curiosity. I think it's one of the best things about being human is that we do care. We do have an interest in what goes on around us, the same way we have an interest in art and music, and, you know, and philosophy. You know, these are things that are just part of human nature, that we appreciate those things, that they're part of what makes life living is being able to have these flights of fancy and curiosities and being able to explore and increase our knowledge. So, you know, I don't know what the practical applications of anything will be, but I do think that these kinds of explorations are just part of what we feel compelled to do as humans.
As a theoretical astrophysicist, Is part of what you're doing, either consciously or subconsciously, either proving or disproving the God factor?
No, I don't think so. I don't think it has anything to do with that. Well, I think that,
as far as I understand, according to science, the Bible was wrong when it comes to the 7 days of creation.
Well, I mean, the Bible is a very old document that, right. that I don't think, I mean, I have something of a religious education and from my perspective, I don't think the Bible was ever meant to be a literal statement of facts and a history book. I think there are much deeper and more interesting stories in there than an accounting of literal events. But, that's just my perspective on the Bible. I know that people have different perspectives on religious texts, but in my work, I'm not trying to say anything about people's personal beliefs. I'm just looking at data and trying to learn something about the cosmos. And if there are religious beliefs that give people different ideas about the cosmos, people are welcome to believe what works for them. But if you want the scientific picture, we have a method for figuring that out. And I find that method to be very useful for the kind of data I'm trying to get and the kind of information I'm trying to get. But I don't try and interact with theology in my work.
I do know for a fact that there are many people, even in today's society, who believe that science is way overstepping its authority when it comes to trying to understand and basically saying, listen, the book Bible is nothing but a book. It's science fiction. Let's get on with reality. I just wanted to ask you your opinion, that's all. There is something I know that you're very excited about, and that's the concept of cosmic dawn and reionization. Can you share what that is with us?
Yeah, it's something I've worked on in my research. It's the time in the universe when the first stars and galaxies were beginning to shine. Mm-hmm. And it was within the first billion years or so of the universe. So very early on, galaxies began to form and stars formed within them. And the universe went from being a dark place to a bright one. And there's it's an interesting time in the cosmos because we're trying to understand how those first galaxies formed, how those first stars formed, and we are currently developing new telescopes that can start to look at some of those first galaxies. So the James Webb Space Telescope, which will be launching in the next few years, is one that will be looking at some of the early galaxies, and there's a set of radio telescopes called the Square Kilometer Array that will be looking at the hydrogen gas from which those first galaxies and stars were forming, and we're just at the point of being able to detect that the beginning of the dawn of starlight in the universe. I think that's a beautiful thing, and I think it's amazing what we're going to be able to see.
But what will we be able to do with this knowledge?
Well, we'll have a better understanding of where we came from. Where galaxies came from, where stars came from. We'll have a better picture of the story of the universe. There are a lot of gaps in our understanding of the cosmos, and we'll be starting to fill some of those in. So, as an astrophysicist, I find this to be a very exciting prospect because, we want to know where we came from. We want to know how it all fits together and how it works. And so we're getting more data. We're learning about that now.
All right, stand by. We've got to take our final break. And Exonation, our guest this hour, is Dr. Katie Mack. Her website is astrokatie.com. And she can always be found on Twitter. Her Twitter feed, her Twitter is at Astro Katie. We'll be back on the other side of this break as we wrap up this hour here in the X Zone from our broadcast center and studios in Niagara, Ontario, Canada. Don't go away.
I've been driving all night, my hands wet on the wheel. There's a voice in my head that drives my heel.
And welcome back. This is the X Zone. I am Rob McConnell, coming to you from our broadcast center and studios in Niagara, Ontario, Canada. Our website is xzoneradiotv.com. And for the X Zone TV channel on Simul TV, xzonetvchannel.com. If you'd like to send me an email, xzone@xzoneradiotv.com. And for all the shows that we have available for you 24/7, 365 on the X Zone Broadcast Network, visit that site at xzbn.net. Dr. Katie Mack is our guest. AstroKatie.com is her website, and on Twitter at AstroKatie. When you were writing your book, Doctor, The End of Everything, what was the inspiration for writing a book that talks about the end of everything?
You know, I've always been interested in the question of where we came from and where we're going. That's just part of my curiosity about the universe. But specifically, you know, I'd been giving a lot of public lectures about things like dark matter and dark energy. And I noticed that when I was talking about the end of the universe, people would really respond well to that part of the lecture. People were very excited and curious about these topics, because I think people don't hear that much about it. There are a lot of books about the beginning of the universe. There's a lot of discussion about the Big Bang. But people don't hear that much about the end. There aren't very many books about the end of the universe. And so I thought it would be an interesting topic to dig into. I thought it would be fun to research what the possibilities are and what we're learning about them. And it was also something that seemed like a nice vehicle for talking about a lot of my favorite topics in cosmology and in astronomy.
When you're out giving lectures, what are some of the questions that you get asked by the people who attend?
Oh, all sorts of questions. I get asked a lot about dark matter. A lot of people hear about dark matter and dark energy, and because a lot of the information we have about dark matter and dark energy sounds very indirect. If you're not used to dealing with that kind of data, a lot of people say, "Oh, isn't that just a fudge factor? Aren't you just, you know, getting the math wrong, and it's not really out there?" And so I have to explain what the evidence is and how we get it and why we build these things into our models. So I get those questions a lot. I just get a lot of questions also about, you know, about the Big Bang and how we know about that and what we know about what could have come before it, if that's possible. I do get a lot of questions about aliens. Everybody wants to know if we're alone in the universe.
Well,
and that's,
yeah, I was going to go there, and then I figured, no, this lady is not going to go there. But let me ask you.
Sure.
Do you think that this planet is being visited by extraterrestrials from other planets?
No, I don't think so.
You know what? I agree with you.
Yeah.
I really do. You know, I've been doing this show for 30 years now. And over the years, there has been not one shred of evidence to substantiate any claim whatsoever.
Yeah.
That this planet is being visited. There's a lot of hype. The internet certainly has spawned a vast following of those who really believe, you know, the alien abductions, everything from alien abductions to Bigfoot. And after 30 years, you know, people say, "Rob, why are you such a skeptic?" It's not I'm a skeptic, Doctor. I want to believe.
Sure.
But show me the proof.
Yeah.
Do you remember do you remember that Wendy's commercial, "Where's the beef?"
Yeah. Yeah, no, and, you know, I grew up watching The X-Files, and I thought, you know, I wanted to believe in that stuff, too. I thought it would be awesome, but, you know, we have really amazing recording devices carrying around in our pockets all the time these days, and there's still, you know, we don't have solid evidence. Like, there are lots of sightings here and there. There are lots of little grainy photographs and things like that, but, yeah, you'd think that there'd be something more solid if there was actually anything really going on.
Do you know... there was a study done, and there are less photos now being taken of so-called UFOs than before. We all carried these high-definition cameras in our cell phones.
Yeah.
And also, one of my biggest kicks when I was getting into this years and years ago was debunking the photographs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, my goodness, it was easy once the good software came out, you know, layer on top layer. There you go.
Yeah.
Why do you think people need, is there a connection between the work that you're doing where, you know, you yourself are intrigued by the beginning and the end. Do you think that subconsciously the people who believe in extraterrestrial existence that are visiting this planet want to believe because they're afraid of the end?
I think it's a little bit more subtle than that, maybe. That it's that we want there to be a more coherent story. You know,
right.
we don't like the idea of just existing in the universe with no higher powers guiding us. And I think that that the idea that there are aliens coming around who are more intelligent than us, who can you know, control us or influence us in some way, is sort of bizarrely comforting, because it would mean that there's some greater purpose, there's some kind of secret knowledge that you could have that would be, you know, telling you something deep and meaningful about the universe, and not, you know, rather than just, you know, we're kind of out here,
right.
We're on our own, nothing particularly exciting is happening to us, you know.
Well, you know,
I think it's maybe more that.
I even had somebody contact me the other day saying, Rob, I've got proof the aliens are here.
Mm-hmm.
I said, you know, years ago I would have been dancing on the ceiling, but now it's, okay, tell me about it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Rob, COVID-19.
Right.
I said, okay. Well, Rob, don't you get it? I've been tested and I don't have it. No, Rob, it was the aliens who brought it here.
Right.
I said, how can you come up with that? Well, Rob, if you look at the timeline, it has everything to do with that sighting that the jets took, the photographs that I saw on CNN.
Yeah.
Please.
Well, we want to find patterns. We want to find order, you know, and
it's
hard to think that things just happen, you know, and that we're kind of powerless to do a lot about what's going on around us sometimes.
But, you know, when you look at what we've done through the existence and the history that we know, this is an exciting place. There's always something going on. And I admire the work that you do, Doctor.
Thank you.
Where we have to, I've always said that in order to prepare ourselves for a better future, we have to know our past.
Mm-hmm.
We have to know what we've done in history. And the work that you're doing with your fellow scientists are giving us the ability to go forward in a way that 20, 30 years ago, we had no idea. So I want to thank you for the great work you're doing.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. It's my part is very small, but I think it's a very important endeavor that we're exploring, and we're trying to understand where we came from and maybe where we're going as well.
No matter how small your part is, when you take a little eyedropper, add it to the ocean, that's a major part. So thank you for your hard work.
Oh, thank you.
Tell us about your experiences, if any, at the Large Hadron Collider.
Well, I have visited CERN. I was fortunate enough to be able to get a tour of the place. As a theorist, I don't often get to hang out around big experiments and machines, but once in a while, I get to check them out, and that's really cool. So last year, I spent about 10 days visiting both the theory group, because there is a theory group at CERN as well, where I was talking to people about various end of the universe scenarios and doing calculations there. And then I was also able to go down underground and look at some of these particle colliders and these amazing machines. And it was really incredible. I mean, the complexity of these instruments is just astonishing. You know, you have these machines that are, you know, maybe 20 meters tall, 25 meters tall or something.
Right.
And they're completely decked out in electronic, in, you know, wires and detectors. Then there's this 27 kilometer ring of, you know, pipe guided by magnets where the particles circulate around and then collide. And it's all got such amazing precision and on such an incredibly large scale. It's really, really something to see it, and the number of people it takes to do that work is just immense. And it's really an amazing achievement to bring that all together.
I think the world can take a lesson from the scientific community when it comes to people working together for the same cause, the common cause.
Yeah, it's a very international field. It's one of the things I like about physics is that, you know, you really do get people from all over the world working together, sharing ideas, you know, collaborating to just to find answers.
Do you feel that the governments of the world are putting and investing enough money into the work that you and your other scientists, when it comes to theoretical astrophysicism, is that a word, astrophysicism?
Astrophysics, I think. I mean, I feel like I'm professionally obligated to say that they should give us more money.
I agree with you.
You know, I mean, we could certainly do more with more money, and basic research like theoretical physics has such a high return on investment in terms of what comes out of it with new technologies and so on. So I do think it's worth putting more funding into, because I think we could do a lot of good with that. But, you know, I don't think it should be the only thing we pay attention to. I think we should also put more funding into making sure people don't go hungry and,
bingo. You know,
healthcare and things like that.
Yeah. I'm one of the guys who, I guess I'd be a rare guy in this industry who says, you know what, we're spending way too much money on manned spaceflight. You know, why don't we use more robotics? I agree with you. Why? Do we really need to step foot on Mars? You know, like, I understand. Well, I understand it's the exploration challenge. I understand that. But if you and your other astrophysicists don't have to use the machinery in order to do your work, wouldn't a robot suffice in doing the work that they're planning on spending all this money on, instead of, like you said, send a robot up, but spend the money here on Earth helping solve the solutions to the problems that we're facing here as a species, a global species, on a daily basis?
Well, I think that these things can all be part of the same picture. I have a little bit of a conflict with this, because I have applied for the NASA astronaut program. One time when I applied, I made the first cut, so I'm not entirely disinterested party in this endeavor. I do think that if we had more money for robotic exploration, we could get a lot more science done.
Right.
And I know that a lot of space scientists are frustrated by how much the crewed space program does get, you know, more funding in certain ways. But I don't know. I think there's usefulness to human spaceflight, but maybe the balance, you know, is appropriately more on the robotic side, and maybe should be even more on that side. I don't know. But you know, personally, I still want to go out there, so I can't give it up entirely.
Well, I'll keep my fingers crossed for you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Doctor, I want to thank you ever so much for joining us. It's been a delightful hour. Once again, I appreciate the work that you and other members of the theoretical astrophysicist community do. You're a valuable part of science. And please keep up the great work. And to you and yours, be safe in these very trying times.
Thank you. And you as well. And I've really appreciated our conversation. It's
Take care great. Of yourself, Doctor. We hope to have you back on in the future.
Thank you.
All right, ExoNation, if you'd like to get a copy of Dr. Mack's book, The End of Everything, it's available at all fine bookstores, anywhere online as well, brick and mortar, if you can get out in these COVID situations. Her website is, all right, here it is, astrokatie.com. And on Twitter, at astrokatie. Fascinating lady, I wish her luck. We'll be back on the other side of this commercial break with the news at 6:30 past the top of the hour as the X-Zone continues in our boiling hot studios thanks to an engineering problem in Niagara, Ontario, Canada. I'm Rob McConnell. Don't go away.